So to do, I will talk about severe asthma, mainly focus on the management. But I think before talking about the management, it is very important to define a little bit severe asthma and the diagnostic approach. Well, of course, asthma is a major public health problem around the world. The prevalence is very high in the Western countries. The USA, I think we have numbers here in Lebanon very similar to westernized countries. The definition of severe asthma actually differs between societies or between health authorities. So if we take the WHO, for example, you see that the definition of severe asthma is basically difficult to treat, treatment-resistant asthma. So they think that whenever a patient who has asthma is difficult to control is considered severe, refractory or corticosteroid-resistant asthma, and asthma for which control is maintained only with the highest steroid dose is also considered as severe asthma. If we go to the ATS definition, they have more strict criteria how to define severe asthma. So the major, one of the major criteria is oral corticosteroids, high dose, or any dose of oral corticosteroids for more than 50% from the last past year. And I think this is, as a major criteria, is very common. It's a very common thing that we see in our clinic. Continuous high-dose steroids, and by high-dose steroids, you all know it's around 1,000 micrograms per day. And they have seven minor criteria, among them concurrent use of at least one other controller medication, daily symptoms requiring short-acting beta-agonist despite good treatment, FEV1 less than 80%, one or more urgent care visits in past year, more than three oral steroid bursts in the past year, so again, steroid dose of 25% and near fatal event. So if you see these definitions about the WHO and the ATS, you see that it's really, the definition is very wide, and we can consider many of our patients as having severe asthma. I will not bore you about pathogenesis of asthma that you all know, but it is important to know that we have many factors that may lead to severe asthma, genetic, obesity, allergens, tobacco smoke, air pollution, etc. What is known about asthma that we saw in the previous lectures, we have too many good treatment about asthma, but still we still have uncontrolled asthma and a lot of exacerbation and flare-ups. So this is from the WHO 2013, where you see that a major part of our patient is still uncontrolled despite good therapy. Now, we all heard about phenotypes of asthma. I think it is a nice thing, although I will show you that we have now different classifications about asthma. But for the phenotype, we have to think about the triggers, whether it's allergens, aspirin-induced, about the inflammation, eosinophilic versus neutrophilic, and this actually will lead basically to different management and response to treatment. Okay, so this is one of the classification that differs between neutrophilic and eosinophilic, or when you have an allergic early onset asthma, this is the good asthmatic because we have too many options to treat him. The adult onset eosinophilic asthma, which is a little bit more difficult to treat, and the late onset highly symptomatic asthma, which is the most difficult to treat. So the allergic early onset are patients who start allergy and asthma early in childhood. They have high IgE and good response to ICS. The eosinophilic severe asthma, it's adult onset, non-atopic, male predominant. They have rhinosinusitis, polyposis, sometimes aspirin sensitivity. We find a lot of eosinophils, and they have a high risk of future exacerbations and relatively resistant to ICS. And the late onset, highly symptomatic asthma, these are female predominance after the age of 40 or 50. obesity, menopause, no fixed airway limitation, airflow or obstruction, response to bronchodilator is different. In the blood and the sputum, we don't find commonly eosinophils, mainly or sometimes neutrophilic, and they have a poor response to steroids. So in each of these phenotypes, you can have severe asthmatics or harder to control asthma. So this is basically the phenotype-based asthma therapy. You have the eosinophilic and the non-eosinophilic. And as we will see, the management differs very well. And that's why it is important to classify this group of patients. This slide shows you, it's an immunology slide, a slide taken from Nature, January 2015. Where you have this part of allergic eosinophilic asthma. So you see all this Th2 phenotype with the interleukins that are involved, in particular IL-4, IL-13, and IL-5. I'm pointing about these because I will talk about them in the management. And then you have the non-allergic eosinophilic group, where you have more, no Th2, but other interleukins, especially interleukin 33 and the TSLP that are very important in the bacterial role of exacerbation. And that's why it is important basically to differ. Of course, the eosinophilic is mainly triggered by allergens, whereas the non-eosinophilic or neutrophilic can be triggered by tobacco smoke, pollutants, etc. So this is the definition about, and the phenotypes I just spoke about are listed in the GINA guidelines. And this is the GINA assessment in adults and children, where you have to assess the level of control, well-controlled, partially controlled, and uncontrolled, that you know very well. So in the GINA guidelines, whenever we are talking about severe asthma, we are talking step 4 and step 5. And you see the guidelines for step 4, so a medium to high dose ICS-LABA, and then you can add tiotropium, which is the new, it is new in the new guidelines, high dose ICS leukotriene antagonist, and maybe theophylline, although I have a very bad experience with theophylline, so I never use it, but it is in the guidelines. And then the step 5, where you have short course steroids and, of course, the anti-IgE that we'll talk a little bit about it. So it is important to differentiate between uncontrolled asthma and severe asthma, and that's in the treatment, because uncontrolled asthma may be a regular asthmatic who is not adherent to his medication, who is not taking enough medications, whereas a severe asthmatic is somebody who needs, from the beginning, a lot of treatment. So the classification of severity is the presence of, the clinical feature before treatment is started, or also whenever the treatment is established, whether the patient is controlled or not. So how you assess risk factors for severe asthma or for poor outcome? If you have ever a patient who was ever intubated for asthma, he's already very severe. He has uncontrolled asthma symptoms and more than one exacerbation per year. And when, with exacerbation, we mean using oral steroids, etc. If they have low FEV1, even after treatment, they have poor adherence, smokers, obese, pregnant, blood eosinophilia. So all of these patients have a high risk factor for poor asthma outcome. For fixed airflow limitation, we have mainly as risk factor if they are not taking inhaled steroids, smokers, occupational exposure, mucus hypersecretions, and again, hypereosinophilia. For medication side effects, of course, if they are taking a lot of oral steroids, if they are on very high dose ICS or P450 inhibitors. So how to distinguish between uncontrolled and severe asthma? First of all, before we classify a patient having severe asthma, we should check about the adherence. We should look at them. I know this may seem very obvious or very easy, but I think we have to emphasize on adherence. confirm the diagnosis of asthma, because basically if you have a patient who you know he has asthma and you gave him the medication that he's supposed to take, he should get better. And you have to remove potential risk factors, comorbidities, etc. So we have to watch the patient using the inhaler, confirm the diagnosis, etc. And finally, if we have all this and still we have a severe asthmatic or uncontrolled asthmatic, we should refer to a specialist or severe asthma clinic. So management plan, again, adherence, therapeutics. I will not detail all of them because you heard about them all the time. I think it is important particularly to identify special asthmatics like aspirin, exacerbated respiratory disease, like aspergillus, so ABPA, or cough induced by occupation. It is important to talk about dietary supplements. It was very too many studies. One of them is published in the New English by Camargo, who is an ED physician, talking about the importance of supplementation with vitamin D. Of course, if we have severe asthmatic and atopic or allergic, we can use sublingual immunotherapy and biologics. So this algorithm actually will tell us how to proceed. So we have an uncontrolled asthmatic. We go to step 5 or step 4. So high-dose ICS-LABA, add-on whatever, tiotropium, leukotriene antagonist. And then we start thinking why he has uncontrolled or severe asthma. Does he have reflux? Does he have allergy sensitization and he's still exposed to the allergen, persistent IgE elevation, persistent eosinophilia, or he has chronic infection like sinusitis or bronchitis? And then we address each level in order to have a better control. And then we consider if after addressing all these problems, we still have uncontrolled asthma, then we have to consider other possibility or other diagnostic. Of course, vocal cord dysfunction is something to think about in a young patient, bronchiectasis from primary immunodeficiency if the patient is requiring a lot of antibiotics, otitis, and CF in young patients. Okay, now I will talk a little bit about small airway disease, because we know that small airway disease have been implicated in severe asthma or uncontrolled asthma. And studies have shown that small airways dysfunction have led to severe uncontrolled asthma, higher number of exacerbations, presence of nocturnal asthma, more severe bronchial hyperresponsiveness, exercise-induced asthma, and late-phase allergic response. So I think small airways have to be addressed, have to be treated. I know that it is very funny because it's like a trend that we start talking about small airway disease because some companies are doing some marketing and then we forget about them. But I think this is an important issue. We still have to think about small airway disease and to control them in order to have controlled asthma. Of course, the effect on treatment, we spoke about extra fine particles. I think this still is valid because extra fine particles have a better deposition in the small airways. Okay, now the last part of the presentation, I will talk about the role of biologics in the treatment of severe asthma. And in order to talk about the role of biologics, I put this slide because it illustrates very well. This is from Nature Immunology, January 2015, because it illustrates really how complex asthma can be and how many interleukins and cells are implicated in this pathophysiology. In particular, we have to know the role of central role of eosinophils. We have to know the role of interleukin 5, interleukin 4 and 13, and of course all the other interleukins, especially interleukin 33, as mentioned before. So if you take an asthmatic and you have an allergic TH2 polarization or preference, you have the role of IgE, a central role in this part. So let's talk a little bit about IgE. Of course, IgE is our dear immunoglobulin for allergy. And IgE will bind to mast cells and basophils, mainly mast cells with the receptor Fc epsilon R1, and it will induce all the inflammatory mediators. And of course, we know that anti-IgE or omalizumab is the only step 5 treatment with category A evidence. Well, because we cannot do a placebo-controlled study with steroids. So of course, steroids is included in step 5, but anti-IgE have been studied very well. And I will show you a few slides about the control that we can achieve with omalizumab. And this is even 1 year after stopping omalizumab, we still have a very good control. Omalizumab in allergic asthma, I'm sure you've seen all these slides before, but have been shown to control very well, reduce exacerbation, and improve quality of life in patients with severe asthma, and also control daytime symptoms, nighttime symptoms, beta agonist used, and lung function. So that's for the omalizumab. As you heard from Dr. Nathan, we have now mepolizumab, anti-IL-5, and it's a humanized monoclonal antibody. Early studies published in Lancet maybe 8 years ago didn't show major improvement, but when they selected actually the right population, it showed a very good response, reduction of exacerbation, reduction of use of systemic steroids, and acute exacerbation. And of course, we have to choose, and that's why it is important to know the phenotype of the patient in order to choose the right population that will actually have a good result with mepolizumab. Reslizumab is another anti-IL-5 that is also launched in the USA and I think Europe. Also improved lung function, reduced sputum eosinophils, mainly with severe eosinophilic asthma, and reduced the frequency of asthma exacerbation. Another biologic that is also have been studied is the anti-IL-13, and this there is a very nice study published in the New England, and in this study I only choose one slide to show you that the responders to anti-IL-13 had high periostin level in the blood, and this is the group that responded to anti-IL-13. Just all this shows you that biologics are very important, but they have to be applied in selected patients whenever we have a nice profile in order to have a good response. Dupilumab, anti-IL-4 receptor, also has a lot of hope, I think, in allergic disease, atopic dermatitis, but also asthma, and it significantly decreased the incidence of asthma control in subjects with moderate to severe, again, eosinophilic asthma. Bronchial thermoplasty is another treatment for severe asthma. I don't think we have it yet in Lebanon. There is also a very nice article published in the New England about the role of bronchial thermoplasty. This data here I'm taking from Dr. Kutayba Hamid in the Annals of ATS, March 2016. Where he states that, of course, bronchial thermoplasty had improved asthma and severe asthmatics, but it improved also quality of life, lowered the rates of exacerbation, but also how to select patients who will respond to bronchial thermoplasty is still a very big question. And my last slide is unanswered questions, again taken from Dr. Hamid's article. Too many unanswered questions. What is the natural history of severe asthma? Is severe asthmatic will remain asthmatic all the time? Does it develop since childhood? Do we have asthma since childhood that stays severe? Does severity persist in some while progress in others? Do they have a unique endotype or phenotype? What are the severe endotypes? Of course, gene-environment interaction is essential in any allergic disease and, of course, in asthma. I think we spoke a lot about airway remodeling in the past. I don't know why we forgot about it, but it is still very important to talk about remodeling. And I think biologics have shown, in particular omalizumab, a good effect on remodeling. And again, how to have the valid biomarkers in order to select the proper and the right treatment for our patient. In the era of biologics, I think people spoke about personalized medicine. Now they are talking about precision medicine. So there's still a lot to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla, for your very interesting talk. If you have any questions, please. What is your feeling about anti-cytokines?
About?
Anti-cytokines.
Anti-cytokines, like the biologics. I think all the studies showed that whenever you select properly the patient, I think we have a lot of hope that they will work very well. The only thing is we cannot generalize the use in all our asthmatics. But mainly because I'm an allergist, so allergic asthma has much more chance to eosinophilic asthma and allergic asthma to respond to this treatment.
Thank you.